I'm really pleased that we've got Teresa and Alison here because one of the things that I've noticed, because I get to meet so many wonderful poets, and I've got to know both of these ladies over the last years, is that poetry is something where it's a sort of reflection of the psyche of the poet. And when you have people who are particularly lovely, as these two ladies are, their poetry sort of shows that, both in what they observe and how they present it. And obviously, I know nothing about poetry except for what I like. And you guys sort of encapsulate that, because you present what it is that you observe, and you do so in a wonderful way, for which we are all grateful. If you like what it is that we do here in tomorrow, we have Paul Bogart, who's doing a presentation on dark skies. He's one of those dark skies experts. Apparently, most of us don't get to see the sky. We do here. We're very blessed, and that's why he's here. He's doing a dark skies thing in the area, and he's going to be presenting with us. So if you can make that. In 2 weeks' time, it's the launch of another edition of June's Review. So if you're one of the folks who are in it, you'll be here. Come early, because it's standing room only. We have other events that are listed on our website. Do take a look for that and look at our Facebook page, because we do a lot in the fall. So do come on by. But without further ado, you are here for the poets. Which one of you ladies is beginning?
The guest.
Alison. The guest.
Alison.
The guest. Do you live here now? Is that how that works?
Oh, not here.
I see. The guest. Alison's our guest. She's starting.
She drove all the way up.
She drove all the way up from
Ann Arbor.
Ann Arbor. Did you?
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Thank you for coming. That would have really sucked if it was just me and you. And then Alison. Hi. We advertised it as the wrong day. That would be really bad.
If the Tigers were playing tonight.
I know. Yes. Anyway, without further ado, thank you so much. Alison Swan.
Peter, thank you for that. And I'm just going to repeat, thank you. It's I absolutely love to be in a room full of people willing to pause for poetry. I'm mostly going to read from my new chapbook, which is called Before the Snow Moon. The last time I read here, I read from Dogheart. I don't think I may decide to read a poem from there. And then I'm going to try out a couple of brand new poems. And I always like to do that at readings, because you can sort, we're being recorded. I may change my mind a little bit about what I read. But usually readings are not recorded, so it's sort of risk-free. You know, you read a new poem and then you can sort of feel, oh, oops, that was not working. And but since we're being recorded, that does change things a little bit. Okay, so everything in here is not brand new, obviously, and I'm going to begin with a poem called In Medeas Res, and it's a literary term that, for whatever reason, I fell in love with really young. And it's, of course, in the middle of things, and that's how a traditional epic begins. This poem is not an epic. But it is, it was born in the middle of the state, in the middle of the night, in what I hope will be the middle of my life. All the traveling through day or dark pursued, this song or that playing through the essential air, shadows crisscrossing fields and roads prettily, moon glinting off the car's interior chrome, this dark spangled with bling, spangles, the dapple gray stallion summer camp girls rode through fields, probably decades dead, buried, buried, the fervent hope, not used in some unwritable way. Oh, please. The old obsession with horses carried right into the middle of life upon the engineered skin of the earth, where the forest has given way to field, has given way to concrete, and built. How natural it all feels, how inevitable, until the nighttime light evokes a ghost from the transition time. Grasses and flowers underfoot, gray mane under hand, hair blown back like a pennant on the pole of a ship that sailed upon a wilderness of sea. Cicadas for a soundtrack, and the wind. I can't quite shake my feeling of this kind of low-grade mourning every time I drive through Michigan, because I've been driving through Michigan since I was born, and I've spent a lot of time in other parts of the country. And land use is a little bit harebrained sometimes in Michigan. The next poem is that I'm going to read is called Leaves, and I think this is one of the ways we connected, and because I mentioned that I am in love with leaves, and I think they're one of the coolest things ever. And it's from a different period in my life, an earlier period in my life, and I think it's about me, but I think it's maybe not about me, but I'll let you do with it what you like. But it began with some childhood memories. She's been becoming this way forever. Once upon a time, from the crook of a young ash tree, she can still climb in her imagination, although it didn't grow old. It was quiet there and green, roofless and saturated with everything she knew she needed. Under the rough bark, under her young limbs, phloem and xylem moved gallons of the precisely right solution to keep growing root and twig and leaf and tree. The world called realistic careened along below. She could watch it all, and sometimes she did. The chaotic slurry of cars and cleaning and tearing to pieces. Most times she stayed in the green world, climbed down but stayed. Every evergreen scale of the spreading juniper where she slid from civilization to enchanted forest, carrying on plant making. This and nothing less than this was all around her skin when she was girl and green and traveling between the present and the hungry future. There is a beautiful, beautiful new anthology out called Poetry in Michigan, Michigan in Poetry. Teresa and I both have poems in it. And I'm going to read the poem that's in it. For going on 3 decades now, I've been, visiting is maybe not quite the right word, but encountering a rescue boat that was placed in the dunes near Lake Michigan, near Saugatuck. And it's far from a road now. It's a bit of a mystery, and it's by now very decayed and completely unusable, but it's still there. And one of the things that I really have come to cherish about Michigan's landscape is the way you come upon human artifacts far from any kind of what would be a current civilization, I guess would be the way to put it. And so you're constantly reminded that there really is no wilderness. You know, people have been walking and moving through almost every place on the planet since people were walking. And I like being reminded of that. Lifeboat. Slipping down the pitcher's thistle dune slope at the edge of a freshwater sea. I recall the lifeboat, wooden on a wooden rack, paint peeling. There for so many years behind the four dunes, miles from any road in the dune grass shade of the cottonwoods, steps from the beach. But nearly in the woods, so who'd have been there to see, carry, launch, paddle, rescue, in this land scrap, without sidewalks? Land where what assembles, assembles according to some fierce green fire, even clouds tinged green, reflecting lake and shore, and out there, cold, fresh water, huge, heavy body of it, under condensation that's cloud, the sea in the sky. We look up, see doorways to space, stars, planets, Saturn, say, which photographed in infrared looks elegant as the Titanic, pulling away from the white star dock for something inimitable as outer space. Perhaps a child's thought, perhaps others, not enough lifeboats. Absolutely sinkable. Surely someone thinking, however clever, were terrestrial creatures who must stay warm or die. Oh, to know the ones who took care here, installed a boat on shifting land, where creatures that crawl and fly are the sole witnesses to the vigil. To know the purchase of their steps, the stories they told, the things they remembered, what they lost, and how. A young poet who was at one of my readings observed that there are a lot of ghosts in my writing and in my poems, and I was really grateful for the observation because I had never noticed. I think it has to do with that thing I mentioned a few minutes ago about how in Michigan you're constantly encountering vestiges of what came before. And the same is true in Washington State. It's not something that's unique to Michigan, I'm sure. This poem is called Before the Snow Moon. It's got a ghost. Everything in the poem happened, and that's often true of my poems, but it's not always true. So I like to tell you that about this poem. Frozen lagoon blown clear by real wind, we simply sat on the ice to lace our skates. No matter that the enclosing dunes were modest, we were tucked in among mountains. On the other side, someone's beagle wailed from the under-reconstruction lighthouse, and the ice-cold Great Lake rolled silent with somnolent fish. A bitter northeasterly carried highway rumble, and the opaque ice sang deeply. I set my boots on 2-century-old pilings to keep them out of the snow. What ships bumped up against the same stubs before sand filled the river mouth? What canoeists floated summer days when the shores clicked with frogs? A bald eagle soared in from the north. My eye met the eye turned earthward. All of us flying in our separate ways through the same space, watched over by ghosts, certainly. A smudge of brighter than was a gibbous moon, the sun set without fanfare, light damped down to nearly nothing by ferocious cloud cover. Not 5 hours later, I was awakened by a great horned owl. I climbed out from under a pile of quilts and went to the window to lift the sash. Twigs of a young black walnut scraped the gutters. Snowflakes ticked against the glass. Across the next door yard, firs and pines planted when those pilings were driven. Cold air carried hoots and soughs across the sill. I climbed back under to listen to everything. So I think I will read. I'll read a poem from Dogheart. So the dog of the title is my late golden retriever, Keweenaw, named for the Keweenaw Peninsula, who, I don't know if this is disrespectful to say, but she, in my life, she was a bodhisattva. And she continues to be, even though she's gone. And I had the privilege of having my hand on her heart when she passed. And she was old and she was sick, and it was the kind of death that gets described as a good death. And anybody who's lost a beloved human, I'm not drawing a parallel, but it was a let me just read the poem. Dogheart. Kiwa rarely stopped for the camera, and so the whole of her photograph life is movement stopped. I must hold the other images, Kiwa resting, watching, waiting for me to catch up, in my mind. Impossible. Sometimes for me, distracted, obsessed, both. The way not to remember, the way to lose things. Snow wasn't blowing around in the trees just then. Clouds clotted the sky. The nearshore shallows were still and green. That Kiwa and I were there together to see it feels like some sort of miracle, that these feet keep filling with warmth and carrying me along, because the heart I'll never see simply keeps doing its job. And then before I read the new questionable stuff, I'm going to read a poem that this almost never happens for me, but it just arrived whole in a moment. And I have to say thank you to Holly Run Spalding's boot camp, and thank you to my fellow boot campers who are here tonight, because this poem was born in their presence, and what a gift. The title is Obad, and just to remind you, if you forgot, it's a dawn song, and it's often, or traditionally, it's the male lover leaving his woman lover, and so of course I had to play with that a little bit. So it's not a traditional abad. It is good to be mortal, but otherwise flawed, to care and suffer and look out into the lemon light of morning and call it beautiful and feel expectation for the 18,262nd time. I think that's 50 years. Someone will do the math for me, please. But I did it 100 times because I so don't trust myself, but I think it's okay. So I'm being recorded. That's okay. I'm still going to read two of the newest poems that I had brought. I was going to decide between three. Really different from what I've been reading. I'm moving into this phase right now where I'm really inspired by visual art. And when I say inspired, I mean it really engages my imagination. And I find myself carrying images around in my head and thinking about them. And luckily, right in the midst of this, a gallery in Douglas, Michigan invited me to participate in it's going to become an annual, but it was their first annual, Expressions in Ink, and they invited writers to respond to pieces of art in an exhibit that they had by 20 different artists at least. And the piece I chose, I don't think I need to describe it. I hope you'll be able to picture it from the poem. I don't think this is finished, so I'm just kind of, that's my little caveat. I don't think it's finished, but I maybe it is. I know you know the very, very famous aphorism from William Carlos Williams, no ideas but in things. And I'm very fond of thinking about that idea, pushing up against it. Sometimes I try, and I try to have ideas that aren't in things, and it never works very well for me. So the idea, the whole concept was introduced to me by Diane Wachowski at Michigan State 30 years ago, and it's had a big impact on me. So the title of the poem is In Things. The piece of art is called Native Figure Number 70 by David Addix. In Things. If I had a box of sky blue puzzle pieces, Lincoln logs, Legos, beads, Scrabble tiles, bottle caps, playing cards, wooden pencils, embroidery floss, I'd see the toy closet in my cousin's house, board game cupboard at my grandparents', junk drawer at 800 Sunningdale Drive, where I learned to hold onto the smallest pieces of things, because you never know. Even drapery hooks, safety pins, and paper money, feeling throwback, dull as dust, if not exactly discardable. Nothing lusterless here. In this body, stuffed and lanky, both, Native Figure Number 70, clutch of bits collected, sorted, placed, wired, as if electrified, then on, measuring tape toes, plastic lizard thighs, washer pudendum, rhinestone nipples, and a bright red ladybug for a heart. Anyone might start blinking, humming. A Phillips head screw might break into opera. A stick and hook finger start tracing pictures in the air. I left out important information. Part of the figure is Scrabble tiles, and two spelled ah and two spelled on. So would have helped you to know that at the beginning, sorry. So I will close with the newest poem, but it's not, don't worry, it's not brand spanking new as in unconsidered. I have suffered from migraines my whole life. As a child, I just thought that was normal, to be in that much pain that you felt like you wanted to die. They're not nearly that bad anymore, and they're very much under control. But I did, it was a very special day, wedding anniversary. I've parked the car, I'm walking to meet my husband in a restaurant, and I feel one start. So in that moment, I thought to myself, gosh darn it, I'm getting a poem out of this. And it shifted my brain into a different space. I've never written about migraines, so this is my very first migraine poem after decades of migraines. The Woman Without Any Legs, a migraine poem. Below her torso, instead, the sidewalk behind her, which leaves skitter over, while she, with her lovely hair and armload of books or blankets, is unaware she floats or rests upon what's solid. In fact, the sun has given her a halo, and her hands are flowers without stems. Unseasonably warm wind shoves street dust and tree leaves ahead of itself. But they don't swirl where her legs would be, and they don't swirl here. So I turn all my attention to placing one invisible foot in front of the other, while daisy petals fringe the parking structure behind a scrim of glare pulled by my brain, which is busy unmaking sense of the world. Bracing, bracing. I think I will stop there and give you a